This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome Ross Baird to the show. He is president at Village Capital Group and author of The Innovation Blind Spot, Why We Back the Wrong Ideas and What to Do About It. Ross, welcome. How are you?
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Good to have you. And just to give everybody a sense of geography, are you located in Atlanta area?
I am in Alexandria, Virginia right now.
Great. Good stuff. Okay. Innovation blind spot. I mean, certainly there has been some stuff written about this, and we all have our blind spots, our predispositions, our prejudices, and we all live in a certain context, right? So I always like to ask myself, what are we not seeing? What is the impact of things unseen? I always talk about how you can't hear the dogs that don't bark. Does that tie in with the innovation blind spot at all?
Yeah. So I think that we think in our economy that resources flow to the best and most productive ideas. When you take it down to the human level, many great people, many great places, many great ideas are just not on most people's radar. I tell a story at the beginning of my book. I've been investing in startups for the last 10 years, and one of the most impressive entrepreneurs I've met is a guy named Jerry Nemorin. Jerry is an immigrant. He's a first-generation American, and he grew up in South Florida, and he saw his mom get ripped off by check cashers and payday lenders, being one of the 50% of Americans that can't access $500 in emergency. Jerry decided, he was first in his family to go to college. He decided he wanted to go on Wall Street and learn how banking worked so that he could come up with better products and services for people like his mom. So he was at University of Virginia in Charlottesville in business school, got a scholarship there, tried to start a company. And he went out and he raised money for a couple of years and he talked to several hundred investors and completely struck out. So I met Jerry and I said, what's going on? And Jerry goes, you know, investing is all about pattern recognition. When people are looking for ideas, they look for what they know and understand. I'm a black guy. I live in Central Virginia. And I'm solving poor people's problems. When it comes to the investing world, I'm 0 for 3. And I think that that story, if you look at where our investment in startups, investment in new ideas goes, African Americans get about 1% of startup investment. Women get about 2% of startup investment. About 78% of startup investment goes to three states, New York, Massachusetts, California. And 81% of new businesses don't raise investment at all. So, you know, the whole world is not about startups and investment, but using that lens, most people and most ideas don't necessarily have access to the resources that we grow.
Right, so I think right. And just got a comment. I remember seeing your interview where you were talking about this now, and that's why we requested to have you on the show, because I thought it was quite fascinating. And, you know, one of the things you didn't say, but you probably, you know, there's another stat you have on this, I bet, is that it all seems to, I think, very unfairly go towards software-oriented businesses or businesses with big scale opportunities. That's where the capital goes. And there's a lot of just more traditional businesses that are very solid things out there, but they don't attract the capital as much, right?
Oh, for sure. So the venture capital industry, defined by Google and Facebook and people looking for the next Steve Jobs, 0.6% of businesses ever raise venture capital. So that means over 99% of businesses aren't in the tech venture capital economy. And so as we think about where the ideas are, where the solutions are, it doesn't quite match up with our media narrative around innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of hate when I'm hearing it, because it's just overdone, you know, it's playing the victim card is very popular in today's world. And I think it's wrong, you know, really. But, you know, is it the system's fault? Is it, you know, these divisions among race or gender? What's the dynamic here? Why is this happening this way?
You know, I don't think that most people are intentionally missing out on good ideas. It's just the world is complicated. And when people are picking who to hire or who to invest in or where to spend their time, people just go with what they know and understand. So for example, the average investor will say, you know, you should get your friends and family to support your business. Now, if your friends and family have money, that's great. If your friends and family don't have money, if you're someone like Jerry, who grew up in a neighborhood where no one has money, that's more difficult. So, you know, a lot of investors will say the best way to pitch me is to get a warm introduction. You know, I want you to be introduced to me by someone I trust. Now, what happens if you're not one degree away from someone who has money to invest?
Right, and this is why, you know, people are just advantaged in life. You know, a lot of people who their parents have those connections and they can get the introduction, they can get the meeting that someone else can't, right?
Yeah, so I think that the big takeaway is not anything about victimhood. I think the big takeaway is most people in positions of power and influence are unintentionally leaving out entire swaths of the population. And that's very bad if you're trying to solve problems like healthcare, or trying to solve problems like transportation that a lot of people have a lot of very good ideas around how to solve.
Yeah, no question about it. Okay, so I love what you said about how it's investing and, you know, where capital goes. This is so important because I was talking with a friend of mine recently about music and entertainment and, you know, movies and TV and stuff like this. And, you know, how it all seems like it's just society sort of in decline. I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels that way. You know, everything's just getting really kind of trashy. And I mean, I can't even go see a stand-up comedian anymore. It's just gutter, you know. I mean, I'm not a prude, but it's just, you know, too much to the gutter too quickly. And she said, well, why don't the other people get discovered? You know, what about the singers and songwriters of the 70s and, you know, this like romantic music? And, you know, that was great. That was a great era in music, at least, right? And, you know, I said, well, they just don't get the funding. The hip-hop guy and the rap guy is going to get the funding nowadays. And so it's a lot about this pattern recognition. And so do investors, you know, record companies, VCs, angel investors, they see the success of what happened before, right? In the tech world, they see the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons. And then they think, okay, I want to invest in that, the next one of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that the pattern recognition you're talking about? Same thing happens in entertainment, of course. It happens in everything.
Yeah, and I think part of it is I was noticing a lot of patterns, and when I wrote The Innovation Blind Spot, I did a lot of research on the state of our economy, and actually, and this was very surprising to me, entrepreneurial activity is at or near a 40-year low. It seems like we're in a golden age of tech.
It does. Yeah, it seems like it's really high.
But that's not true. The balance of power between large institutions and small has never been on the side of big more. So if you look at advertising, for example, online advertising, you have two companies, Google and Facebook, controlling 85% of the market. There are three airlines. There are two cable companies. In Hollywood, you have a few studios that dominate, and they all want the same thing, the next Marvel, or, you know, from sports movies to romantic comedies.
And the same is true in the news business. It's all become big corporatized duopolies. It's not monopolies, but it's like these duopolies, right? And so it's interesting you say that, because I interviewed the author of, and I like the title of the book. I'm not sure I agree with his, you know, sort of socialistic solutions, but the book is a good title, The Winner Take All Society, right? Mm-hmm. We're living in that era, right? That seems pretty prevalent.
I think so. I mean, I think that the average investor looks for a business that could be 10,000x, but has a very high chance of failure. And I think, followed to its logical conclusion, our entire system that's finding and sourcing and financing new ideas prioritizes wildly unrealistic projections that you're very unlikely to hit over actual real cash flows and revenues and employing people. It prioritizes, I mean, if you look at Theranos, the company that raised nearly $1 billion on a drug test.
And it's a scam. Yeah, right.
Compare that to companies that are doing 2, 3, 5 million in revenue. And because they're unwilling to lie about wild projections,
right,
investors go for it. I think that we have overrated the wildly unrealistic winner-take-all projections, and we've underrated people who are just doing their job every day delivering results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well, what do we do about this? I mean, I think most people listening would agree that it is a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would think it's a problem. I think these large companies that are bigger than the size of many countries are very abusive. I think it's an incredibly scary world we live in when companies like Google and Facebook control 70+% of the world's search traffic and information. it's unbelievably scary. And what they've done recently, regardless of what side of the political aisle anybody is on, is they've blacklisted people and they kick them off their platforms. I mean, think about this, Ross. The phone company cannot kick you off its platform because it's regulated as a utility, right? Everyone has essentially the right, at least in the US, to a phone, right? But if Facebook doesn't like what you say, or Google doesn't like what you say, or Twitter doesn't like what you say, they kick you off their platform. And that would be fine if there was another platform to really go to, right? You know, but, and there are other platforms, we all know this, but they're so much smaller in the winner-take-all society that these really are the size of utilities, these companies. I mean, their GDP is larger than that of many, many countries. It's insane how abusive they can be. And we don't even know how abusive they're being. We only know what we see. We don't know why we see the results we see when we search something on Google or Facebook. We don't know why certain things show up in our newsfeed, because the algorithms are these closely guarded secrets. I think the algorithms need to be public. They need to be regulated like a utility, or they need to be busted up into smaller parts under antitrust, or all three. I'm not sure, but at least one of those things needs to happen.
I mean, Americans have forgotten that they are allowed to govern. And we saw this 100 years ago, where the railroads and the steel and the oil and the banks were
controlled by
a few people. And I think, you know, when the trusts were broken up, and when the banks were localized after the Great Depression, and when controls that gave people the ability to start businesses and produce and not be reliant on these large monopolies to give them A or B, like we've done this before. I think we've just forgotten that we're allowed to. So, for example, when it comes to Google or Facebook, there are all of the people are complaining on both sides about how Facebook or Google are controlling speech and dialogue. I mean, we have a Congress that theoretically is supposed to govern standards of public conduct. And you see a lot of Congress people in question telling Google or Facebook, what regulations would you like us to put in? You tell us how to do it. I mean, I think we are at a point in society, and we haven't seen this for 100 years, where our supposedly free market is not free because the entrepreneur, small producer, is not able to compete. And I think that we need to be able to assert that. And I think that requires courage and governance. And I write quite a bit about it in the book, and the direction that the big outweighing the small has gone. And I think that we do have the ability to lift up the small again. And I think that's what has made the United States of America a great and powerful and resilient country.
Yeah, it really has. The idea of the First Amendment was to protect people from the government and the government suppressing their speech or their right to assemble. When companies become larger than governments, I think you got to apply that same constitutional right to the company if it wants to be that large, because it just becomes very, very abusive. It really does. Okay, so solutions, just any more on how we, I mean, everybody probably listening hopefully agrees this is a problem, the way things have been going. And certainly it's led to lots of innovation. I mean, look, you know, as much as I criticize these companies, and when you're big, you're going to get some criticism, okay? So just deal with it, companies. But they've also been very innovative, of course, and they've brought us great things that we all love, use, enjoy, benefit from every day. But there's got to be some checks and balances, right?
Right. There's, I mean, in terms of solutions, I talked through a few in the book. I think one, you know, we've been talking about big companies and scale. And I think when people think about investing, people are obsessed with doing something at global scale. And I think one of the solutions that I have been very inspired by is thinking about small and thinking about local instead of big and global. So, for example, I work with a firm called Access Ventures in Louisville, and I tell the story of the book, but they chose one of the poorest street corners in their community. On one corner of the street corner was a building that 5 years ago was a brothel. They bought it, they cleared it out, they fixed it up, and instead they put in a bakery that they finance that pays women who used to work in the sex trafficking industry living wage jobs. Across the street, they invested about 20 businesses in a commercial real estate development. Across the corner, they built housing. 5 years later, with just about $4 million worth of investment, created 250 jobs. If you look at the financial returns on the project, they're competitive with anywhere you could have put your money over the last 5 years. But they intensely and intentionally focused small and built a community and turned this place that was incredibly depressing 5 years ago into this thriving community. So, you know, you don't need to invest in the next big tech company that changes the world, because it probably isn't going to. You just need to sometimes look at what's happening in your own hometown or down the street or across town and see what you can do there. So I think encouraging people to start small is one of the things that we could use a lot more of.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There's a lot of very good, solid businesses, artists, things, whatever, to invest in that just do good work and produce good stuff. And they shouldn't be ignored, should they?
No, I think the second thing is innovating in the kinds of investments that we make. So for example, I mean, I write about this in the book, the venture capital industry, the way we finance companies actually came from the 19th century whaling industry. And the idea of today, if I say I'm going to invest in a tech company and 1 in 20 chance it'll be the next grand slam and 19 in 20 chances it will be unsuccessful, it will go bust. That is a kind of winner-take-all risk-return profile that actually comes from the whaling industry. Now, there are a lot of businesses and a lot of industries that are probably much more likely to be successful, probably much less likely to be a multi-billion dollar company. But, you know, you can build a thriving community, you can build a thriving city out of a lot of reasonably successful companies. So thinking differently around the kind of entrepreneur you're backing and not needing to fit the same story or narrative of Silicon Valley, I think is really, really important as well.
Yeah, good point. I want to ask you two more questions and we'll wrap it up. One, and I know you're not a real estate guy, you mentioned that off air before we started, but I just like to ask you to take a stab at this idea. Any thoughts about how this capital formation or capital distribution happens in the world of real estate at all? You mentioned the brothel to the bakery and, you know, the development across the street from it and so forth. You know, just anecdotally, what you notice in your life, if you have any observations there.
Yeah, so I've been very interested recently, the legislation that designated opportunity zones across the country. A significant proportion of places where we've invested have been in opportunity zones, and I'm working with the group Access Ventures, I mentioned, to explore a possible opportunity fund that would integrate real estate and businesses. I think the biggest observation I have is, you know, I live right outside DC, and I talk to real estate investors who are outbidding each other for the top properties in DC and Boston and New York. And they say, well, it's because it's class A real estate, it's prime, it's always going to have tenants. And why would I want to invest in Roanoke or the poorest part of Louisville? Where are the tenants going to come from? There's a different way of thinking about it where, you know, you have a lot more agency to shape the value of the real estate than you think you do. So what Access has done, you know, they've invested in real estate and they've also invested in the companies that are working in the real estate. So in many ways, they've created an intentional ecosystem where they're creating and making a new place. So I would say the opportunities,
the value add opportunity is the idea. And folks, I just want to make a point on that. You know, this mostly applies to larger commercial projects or neighborhood domination type of projects. I mean, you can do it with a one-off single-family home and make it look nicer and so forth, but the big opportunity is more at scale on this type of stuff, obviously. But yeah, you're right. You know, a trophy location property in a high-end cyclical market like where I grew up in Los Angeles or Orange County, California, they have terrible cash flow, those properties. You're investing in, air quotes, more in speculation on just price going up. Yes, they will always be attractive, but at what cost? You have to take a lot less income as a proportion to value in those properties because of this winner-take-all mentality that happens in real estate. Everybody goes for the location, 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 when really the better yield is in the non-trophy property, you know, unless you hit it at the right side of the cycle and you get into a bubble and you get lucky and you time it and then you exit at the right time and then you could do better. Okay, but yeah.
But if you invest in a property that other people are overlooking and would not count a trophy property, and you have to work harder and it's more complicated and you have to pull in the right range of partners, you can add significant value and you can outperform the other people who are all competing over the kind of fully baked trophy property. And I've seen it in businesses, I've seen it in real estate, and I'm encouraged by the opportunity there.
That's a good, I like the way you say that, the fully baked property. You know, that one's done. You can't really add value, you know, and that's a good way to put it. I like that. Last thing, two-pocket mentality. You talk about the two-pocket mentality in chapter 4 and how the short-term thinking doesn't work very well, right?
So a company like Jerry's that's helping poor families get out of debt. And a real estate development like the Shelby Park, Louisville neighborhood, where you convert a brothel into a bakery. I think a lot of people would say, what are you talking about? Is that an investment or is it philanthropy? And when I started Village Capital, I was explaining the types of businesses that one invests in, businesses like Jerry's, to people that I was fundraising from. And one guy said, you know, young man, this is an interesting idea, but I got two pockets. With one, I make as much money as I can. With the other, I give it all away. Which pocket are you asking me for here? And I said, you know, respectfully, sir, I see he was a very successful entrepreneur, very distinguished member of our community. I said, respectfully, sir, I see it a bit differently. I see the world in one pocket. You know, what your money is doing in the world is a reflection of your values. And I think I want to build a career and I want to build a company where, of course, we're a successful business, but we're also doing things that we value. And I can't really separate them. And you know, he didn't invest in me. He didn't get what I was saying. But I do think that we live in a one-pocket world, and we all want to do things that we care about every day. And I think whether it's value-add real estate in economically distressed communities or entrepreneurs developing business models that solve social problems, I do think that there are opportunities to do things that you value and care about in your career, in your day job, and not just in any charity giving you would do, or not just in any volunteer time. And I think that's the kind of company I've tried to build. Those are the kinds of entrepreneurs I've tried to support. And it's a growing movement of people that are thinking very intentionally about this.
Excellent. Ross, give out your website and tell people where they can find out more about you.
Yeah, please go to villcap.com to see the company Village Capital that I founded. The book is The Innovation Blind Spot. You can buy it really anywhere.
All right, Ross Baird, thanks for joining us.
All right.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.